Folks, welcome to the Survival Podcast, episode 3,499, Working in Rural Off-Grid Environments. Cody Grunewald is going to be with me in just a bit. He runs a company that specializes in metal fabrication, fence creation, things like that, and does so largely in places where you're going to be off-grid because there ain't no grid. And we're going to talk about that some, but we're also going to talk more about the lessons learned from that. I'm sure most of us have been on ranches or farms where you're going to be off-grid on part of the place. It doesn't even matter if the place itself is on-grid. When you start talking in acreage, generally power's not everywhere. And when you don't have power and you still got to get things done, you start to learn how to get things done without the grid. And that is a situation that we all end up in sooner or later. You don't think of Dallas, Texas as a place to be off-grid, but for a good 2 days, a lot of Dallas, Texas has been off the grid because we just had storms come through that literally wrecked the shit out of the place. And so we all end up in situations where the power, the gas, et cetera, that we think we can depend on that is tied into this massive infrastructure that makes modern society in its current form possible isn't there. And that's a big part of preparedness. So we're going to dig deep into that and the lessons that Cody has learned from running a business in that environment in off-grid areas, very rural, et cetera. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor today, number one today, is K9 Academy. That's Joel Riles' operation there. I worked with Joel a lot on putting this program together as a barter deal. Our dog Belle is a Fortress K9. From Joel, and we bartered her in exchange for my consulting for the better part of a week where Wendy and Joel were here at our house. And we put together the outline for how this program would work. And we did that with the concept of core obedience being the core of everything, because if you want a dog that's a protection dog, you need core obedience. If you want a dog that's a hunting dog, you need core obedience. If you want a working dog on a farm or a ranch or a homestead, you need core obedience. If you just want a good dog on your homestead that doesn't kill your animals and doesn't do things it's not supposed to do, like run away and hurt visitors who you let in and things like that, then you need core obedience. So that's the primary course I recommend everybody consider starting with. There's a lot of other great courses you can take with Joel. And I'm telling you, he's one of the best in the business of training dogs, not just some of the most amazing protection dogs you will find anywhere, but overall as a trainer. And you know, the thing is, we talk about training dogs, but really the being that needs the training is a human. The human is always the weak link in this environment. So if we teach people to do the right things, we end up with good dogs doing good dog things. Next up today, John Pugliano with the Wealth Studying Podcast. John is an excellent, excellent investment manager. He made himself into a liquid millionaire before he invested a dime of a client's money. That's something not enough people that call themselves financial advisors do, in my opinion. That's why I kind of refer to the industry as a whole as the financial liar industry. John's not one of those, though. He's one of the good guys. He's also a prepper like us. He's a ham radio operator, has that backyard garden, stores the food, does all of the stuff. I first met him, actually, at a prepper convention in Salt Lake City, Utah in 2010. And we're still working together 14 years later, serves on the expert council. He puts out this podcast a few times a month. It's brief. It's to the point. It's about what's really going on with the economics of the situation. His latest episode, I really recommend you check it out if you haven't noticed he's dropped a new episode. But it goes into a lot of the things about what's going on in the world, in Europe, in the Middle East, et cetera, and how that plays into being somewhat conservative on some things right now with your investments. Again, check him out, John Pugliano and the Wealth Studying Podcast. Again, fantastic investment manager, great podcaster, and someone who's served a long time here on the Survival Podcast as our expert counsel. And with that, I want to welcome our guest. Hey, Cody, man, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Hi there, Jack. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited and nervous to be here.
I'm glad you're here with us, man. I think this is a great topic. When I first got your guest app, I'm like, oh, he's working in off-grid environments, and that's cool, and we can talk about metal fabrication and then I realized, like, you were actually pitching kind of this bridge between the two of, yeah, this is what I do, but for everybody that doesn't do it, this is what I've learned by it. So I think that's going to be a great discussion. But before we do that, I want to just start off with, you know, who's Cody and how do you end up doing this kind of work? I mean, my understanding, you grew up in Wyoming, fairly rural to begin with. But you worked in kind of the outdoor rec, ATV, snowmobile kind of retail space for a while. And how does that lead to what you're doing now?
Yeah. I'm a Wyoming guy. I've tried to go a few places, but I always seem to come back. So I can't really escape Wyoming or rural life, I guess. Started off in Newcastle, Northeast Wyoming. And I grew up on, my folks have a ranch up there, and I lived there for the first 18 years of my life. We were 42-ish miles from the nearest town. And as you say about the power grid and some of that stuff, we were the last people on the power line. It literally ended at a water well, and then there was nothing else. So that kind of started off. I went to school at the University of Wyoming for a couple of years before realizing that I don't get to do anything with my hands, and going to be an engineering student and finding out that I'll never actually get to build anything, kind of lost interest in that and bounced around just that, working odd jobs, working at a few ranches. And then my wife and I started dating at the time out of Laramie, and she said, "Hey, you want to move to Lander with me?" So I said, "Sure. Where's Lander?" And one of those where it's a town in Wyoming, but I might have been through once, but didn't even know where I was going. So I applied for a job at Wyoming State Trails, and they do, as you had said, they do the ORV and snowmobile trails for the entire state of Wyoming, based out of Lander here. So it was a unique experience. It was good and bad. There was a lot of travel and a lot of time away from home, which kind of started to be the drag of, I had my first son in 2019, and that was kind of when I was shifting more towards trying to be at home as much as possible and prioritizing family over work. Now, but before we had my son, I started my business on the side in 2017 at the request of some people to do some welding projects, and then kind of picked up slowly working that as a side gig and on weekends. And then finally came to the point in, I know 2020, kind of a weird year to do it, but 2020, I quit State Trails and went kind of full on my own doing metalwork and fabrication. So that was kind of where I went full into the fabrication side. And with fabrication, my dad welded. We were, again, out in the Thule, so you have to fix your own things and build your own things. So we did ag corrals for cattle and basically using old oil field tubing to build corrals. And then I had someone ask me to put a bid in on a fencing project that involved just that metal fencing, but in a rural setting, and kind of snowballed into some different state contracts and whatever work I can get to keep the business going and go another year without getting a day job.
It's interesting. And I can tell you that in certain environments, it's very clear when somebody kind of becomes the de facto standard. For instance, here, you know, every third homestead has a fabricated metal building. And I can tell you with almost 100% certainty that 90% of them were built by the same person. And that they were all built from about 30 years ago to about 20 years ago. Because there's certain little hallmarks that I think different fabricators settle on. And there's like certain ways the skylights are done in these buildings and all. And I've seen that with fencing too. Kind of out to the county to the west of me, you know, you see the certain type of pipe fencing, and like every other fence is clearly built by the same person. I think so that when you get into a point where people know they can rely on you in an environment like that, you probably do have a pretty big market capture of at least what's available.
Yeah, it's good to just that have your own area and your own way of building things. And that's one with the oil field tubing. Everybody has their unique way of doing something. However, there is also 20 other people that do it very similar, that it's hard sometimes to tell the difference.
Yeah.
It's especially in Wyoming, there's a number of people that do it in the state. However, there's that 20 people over an entire state that do something the same way or whatever. it's not an individual thing, but it's also pretty widespread, and then you can...
Becomes kind of like a regional standard.
Yeah, regional standard. The project that I'm working on right now is 140 miles away from my house, and there's maybe two other contractors that would be involved in working on such a project.
Gotcha.
But that's a big old range to have to cover.
So with that kind of work, like, you know, you're going out, you're spending days, maybe weeks before you're back home. During that time, you're dealing with the fact that, you know, you're either running it on solar or a generator or something like that. You're not plugging into a wall because not only is there no power, there ain't no wall.
There's no wall. There's no there's nothing to sustain. And you might be the project that I'm working on right now. I'm probably the only person for about a 6 mile radius that I could scream and yell and do whatever, and nobody's going to hear me. I'm out there fully off.
So with that in mind, are there some maybe tools or things that you use on a daily basis that now you would say, like, anybody that's a homesteader, prepper, that's concerned about off-grid living, whether because they want to or because they know at some point they might have to, should probably look to adding to, you know, what they do, some things that are very utilitarian that spread beyond somebody working in your environment?
Yeah. Again, going from welding into some of the barbed wire fencing, I have a whole wide variety of tools, but I'll jump back to what you had mentioned of the solar. When I first started out with some of this stuff, I did not have, I wasn't fully invested. I didn't have all the tools, didn't have everything. So I started off with some basic solar panels hooked up to like a Goal Zero or the like for a battery. I actually was using some old car batteries at one point. Now with that, then I jumped from solar to a battery or some type of storage. And then I know Toolman Tim or big DeWalt guys, and I'm kind of a yellow and black guy myself. And I found that you can get 12 volt DeWalt chargers, and off of a basic solar panel to even a car battery, you can charge DeWalt power tools. I know you can do that with other brands. I'm just a DeWalt guy. And that makes a big difference of having battery operated hand tools that you can charge with the power of the sun. It makes it easy to, oh, hey, I don't need to go plug into the nearest outlet or whatever it might be. I know you guys had done at one point the DeWalt little, the smaller, I think it's a 14-inch bar chainsaw.
Yeah.
Not the most powerful thing, but if you're trying to do stuff and you're on the homestead and if you have smaller projects, you can do it without being hooked up to the grid, without using gas, without using anything that you have to leave the in the homestead case, leave the homestead to go and get to refuel, which for me became a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, cordless chainsaws and cordless sawzalls have been hugely valuable to me in so many ways. And I would say another tool that's been valuable to me as a cordless tool is the cordless angle grinders. I mean, now, they've also been a curse to some people. I've talked to, like, law enforcement personnel and all said, the day you could get an affordable cordless angle grinder, property theft of, like, shipping containers and shit like that went through the roof. But they are a very useful tool.
Yeah, again, doing some of the welding stuff, I've got a handful of the cordless grinders, and I am not telling people to do this. It's illegal. Don't break into anything. But with a cordless grinder, there's not much that I can't get into within about 5 minutes. It kind of takes security off the radar for some people because a padlock doesn't – I don't want to say it doesn't mean anything, but it doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't. It doesn't. And if you've ever had to cut one off because you needed to and it was okay to do, you know how quickly they come off. You mentioned some other stuff in your notes. So, like, fencing pliers is a multi-tool.
Yeah. I hate having stuff in my pockets, but one thing when I'm especially doing fence work is having a pair of fencing pliers in my back pocket. You can use them for a lot of people are Leatherman people, and for me, that's too small of a tool for a lot of things. Trying to always have a visual aid of a good set of fencing pliers. I think this is a channel lock set, $30, and you have a hammer, a wire cutter, an impromptu wrench, pliers, whatever you might need, and it fits in the back of your pocket. I know for some of the gardening, not gardening stuff, but for different things, this poor thing also ends up being a digging tool and scratching away in the dirt. If I'm working on something in a post, I need to reach 2 inches into the dirt.
Like they're meant to be abused, I think. They actually handle abuse pretty well.
That's kind of one of those. Again, I'm a visual person, so I tried to have different stuff sitting in here.
Yeah.
This poor old pair I've had since on the ranch. I was literally about 12 years old. There's not much left of handles, or I couldn't even guess what the brand would have been. But
yeah,
that set of fencing pliers is 20 years old and has been
that old. Probably a better one. They were all good 20 years ago, you know.
It was a better one, and that's kind of something. Was we talk about being off grid and tools and what you're using. Getting a good set of tools to start off with makes a heck of a difference. If you buy, there's some of it that you pay for a name brand, but also making sure that something isn't complete garbage. If I drive, again, the project I'm working on this spring, I'm an hour and a bit, probably 50 miles from the closest town or anywhere to buy anything. If a tool fails on me, that costs me big money. If it takes 2 hours to go and get something, that's 2 hours that either a welder or a skid steer or myself just lost wages or lost income from a tool failure.
And I found those people called customers aren't generally happy when their work's delayed either. So that's
fair.
Right? You know, you also mentioned that you are pretty big on using ATVs as like a multi-purpose work vehicle. I think that's something a lot of homesteaders can learn a lot from. As you get on these bigger homesteads, people go into all kinds of specialized equipment and vehicles and tractors. And a good ATV to me does a great deal of value, even if it's a four-wheeler with a trailer. But a side-by-side seems to be kind of a better way to go. And one of the reasons I know how valuable they are is I've been to people's homesteads when their ATV's not working, and they're never freaking happy when that's the case.
it's a good back. You can always use your legs. It just might not be the best way to go. Yeah, I'm a big advocate for Honda ATVs just because I've had such good luck, and I put them in rough and insane places, and they always seem to keep plugging along. For me, if I'm in a location that is rough terrain, you're more likely to roll a side-by-side and have some of that issue. That's why I lean more towards an ATV. And I like they're a smaller engine, but I still get them into rougher places. The Honda Ranchers, they're only 400 or 500 pounds. That even if I'm in a jam or in some rough location, I'm a fairly big guy that if I roll a four-wheeler on top of myself, I can most of the time
push
get something pushed off or get out of a bad situation that – just that, a side-by-side. Some of these new side-by-sides are a little bit insane of people that put a full cab and license plate, and it's cool, but if I'm spending $50,000 on a side-by-side with a cab and air conditioning, I can probably just go buy a truck and most of the time.
That's why I don't, even the ones that aren't even that elaborate, you know, I'll be at like an Atwoods or something, which is like Tractor Supply on steroids, right? And it's like the mega mart of agricultural stores. And I'll see these side-by-sides. I'm like, they're pretty cool. And I'll go like $12,000. I'm like, baby, I can buy a used pickup, you know? And
a used pickup that you can run down the road at 70 miles an hour on.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Four-wheelers, I'm with you, because another thing with those is, you know, just a basic come-along. And pretty much if you can manage to get it hung up somewhere, as long as you got something you can anchor to, you can drag it off with your most basic of come-alongs.
Yeah, a basic come-along or a handyman jack. You can jack something up and wedge a log underneath and get out of a lot of rough places. As you'd also mentioned, I'm big because of an ATV. I like because of the size, but I also, as you say, a side-by-side has more carrying capacity. So I lean pretty big into ATV trailers. I've got three or four of them set up for different needs. I've got a Lincoln generator welder that I can pull behind a four-wheeler, and I can take it. Most people don't even want to walk to. I can drag a 750 or 800-pound welder behind a four-wheeler to a location that you'd closer to call a billy goat path.
See, that's probably one of the things that gets you a lot of work, too. The fact that Clumsy says, I need a fence to go from here to here, and you go, I can do that. As long as the budget's there, that the fact that you can do it, we're not negotiating price anymore. It's just like, oh, you can do this. When can you start?
Yeah, that's a big one that you get into some of these rough terrain. And I've rolled four wheelers. I've done a lot of damage to stuff when I've gotten into too rough of terrain.
Yeah. But
most of the time, anywhere that a four wheeler can have traction, I will be able to get materials and tools into that location. And as you say, if the money isn't an issue and you need something in a rough location, I can get you there. The top of a mountain, the top of wherever, you can make do to get something in.
Yeah.
I've even found some of the rough terrain. I might not be able to go up it, but if I can find a way around, and I might have all the tires locked up skidding down a hill, but I can come down some of these slopes that you might not be able to with other things.
Yeah. I think if you can get there with a four-wheeler, you can get there. And if you can't get there with a four-wheeler, maybe you don't need a vehicle there in the first place. I can't remember the name of it, but there's this motorcycle that's known as like the ultimate off-road motorcycle. And when I started the show, people were trying to sell me. I'm like, look, if I need that to go to a place, I'm not going there.
Yeah.
If I can't get in with a four-wheeler or a Jeep, I probably don't need to be there in the first place.
Yeah. Some of those I've seen, I think it was the Rokon,
whatever. That's it.
A two-wheel drive, yeah. Four-wheeler, a two-wheel drive motorcycle. And
yeah.
Gosh, that's a cool thing, but they sacrifice on some of those, the suspension and some of that, that you've got a rough enough ride that you'll be feeling it the next day. And as you say, just get off and walk.
Yeah, that's probably, like I said, if you need that to get where you're going, you probably don't need to be there. Are there any like other things you've learned just day to day working off grid, like food, tools, on the fly repairs, making sure you have fuel? I mean, that ATV ain't really very much use if you try to power it on clover blossoms or jelly beans, right? You got to have fuel for it.
Yeah, they've started to make some of the electric dirt bikes, but again, you've got to have a pretty good solar or something to charge that up. For me, the biggest thing when working off grid or working out in the Thule's is to have a plan. As you say, fuel and absolutely everything. If I don't have it, a mental note of bring a spare gas can because I'm going to be out there for 2 weeks, or bring tools to do whatever. The first step always starts for me with a plan of you have to know where you're going, what you're intending to do. It's not as extreme as a mini bug out, but if I take the camper and a four-wheeler out somewhere, there's a chance that I might be out there for 2 weeks. So you can almost almost plan it like a two-week bug out of take everything you need and you're not coming back. Because in my case, it's not you're coming back to the world has ended. It's I come back and it costs me $500 in lost productivity just to make a trip to town or to do something like that. So the plan is the first one for me. And that's one of those, it's a quote, I might be from a stupid TV show, but if you can be one thing, be efficient of even planning on how you've got to pack stuff. There have been some projects where, okay, I have the camper on behind my truck and a four wheeler on the back and materials that are wedged in every nook and cranny, and okay, one trip and get it done so that way you can get out and be as efficient as possible. As you had mentioned, the next one, if you're out there in a camper or even just rough tent camping or whatever it might be, having food and having food that is either shelf stable or that you can keep refrigerated for that time also becomes a pretty good deal for pretty important factor for me. We bought it for different reasons, but we had bought one of the Harvestrite freeze dryers, and that kind of makes it easy for me of, do I want to spend the money on a Mountain House meal? No, I can freeze dry my own meals and take them to the Thule's. I'm also a pretty big advocate on use anything and everything you can, both old and new school stuff. My wife is pretty big and likes to can stuff, and we can can meat, and I can take something out there and heat it up in relatively short order, or you could eat it cold, but that might not be your favorite thing. But you can heat up either canned foods or freeze-dried foods or whatever and have a diversity while maintaining some of that freshness. That's one with the freeze dryer that everybody rants and raves on, is that you don't lose the nutritional value and it's not stale when you go to do something.
Yeah. What about tools? I mean, you know, you just mentioned like the cost of not having something you need. My wife gets mad at me because we go to Home Depot or Lowe's. I'm always buying extra PVC parts and shit. And, you know, Lowe's is 25 minutes for me. It's not an hour and a half. But I've always said like that one freaking little tiny piece that costs 30 cents at the store cost me $12 when I don't have it. Right. And then what that connects me to is back when I was in the military, I was a mechanic, but I was also a wrecker operator. And I had a Hemet wrecker, this huge wrecker. And we had what we call a TO&E, or table of operations and expenditures, that explained every single tool, every part, every component. Plus, then we had that for our individual toolboxes and stuff. And like not only was there an inventory record, because if you lose something, you end up paying for it. And since they pay you, there's no optionality in that. They just charge you for it. But not only did that define like what was in the wrecker hammock, but where it was. Because that way, when you were out in the mud at 3 o'clock in the morning with like giant mosquitoes eating the back of your ear and you needed that one thing to hook up to that truck, it was, you could reach up and it was there. Right. Have you taken, probably not to that extreme, because that has to be able to go from one soldier to the next and still do the job. But have you taken some extra steps to making sure the tools that you need are where they need to be so that they're not somewhere else?
Yeah. And I'm big on having, I overpack and I overbring, because it's, again, that's lost time or lost money or whatever when you have to go back for something. But for me, I start off with my, I'm a Toyota guy. I ask a lot of my Tundra. However, it does pretty good. But what I did was I put a flatbed on that truck, and then one side of it, I've got about a, I think it's a 14 gallon. It's basically a small fuel cell that I'll carry 14 gallons of extra gas. That's, I've got, it's got a separate small pump that I can fill ATVs or small gas engines or fill the truck up. So starting off with that fuel, and then the next box over on my flatbed, I've got spare tools, and in that I've got a, it's a jump box air compressor. It's a DeWalt because I like my yellow and black. However, that's kind of a big issue to have, is having that tool to be able to self jump and self inflate, because tires and batteries are one of those things that if you have a slow leak or whatever it might be, by the time I want to go home, I need to have that.
Yeah.
And the next box over, I carry a pretty good, for a small truck, carry a pretty good set of mechanics tools just to fix and repair and et cetera, whatever you might need to do. Each of my four wheelers, most of the time I'll bring two or three four wheelers to the field. Each of them also kind of has its own little tool bag with some spare parts or a tire plug kit or something like that.
Sure.
I'm a long ways away from anything that you've got to take care of. Whatever the situation is, as you say, that 30-cent part might not just be not available, but it might leave me stranded. And then I've got to go through some different measures to get help outside or to get somebody else. If I can't get out, then it becomes a bigger issue of how do you get help? And for Wyoming, there's a lot of the places that you don't have cell service that you can't really call for help in that case.
Yeah. One of the things we always did when we used to do the off-road thing quite a bit is things that could easily break that didn't cost much money that you could fix yourself, you carried extra parts for, like hoses, belts, things like that. Like putting a belt, even one of the, you know, these new vehicles, well, new, it's been 30 years now that they've all been like, all these serpentine belts, they're kind of a pain in the ass. But you can get it done if you have a belt. Right. I mean, yeah. If you don't have a belt, there's really no way to. I'm sure the MythBusters could fabricate something or whatever, but not. Yeah,
I'm not ripping up duct tape to make a belt, but there's certain ways that you can limp stuff out, and I've had to do that before as well. Of if you're missing it, you're driving on three wheels to get back to the truck or get back to civilization.
Three wheels and a manhole cover. I remember that episode. They made a wheel out of a manhole cover, and it worked.
Hey, if it works, that's good. That's one of those situations where you've got to do what you've got to do. And the MythBusters of having a roll of duct tape and baling wire, there's a lot you can do with some minimal things too. And I know for people that do homesteading and all of that, having wire, or I know you had talked on, I think, I can't remember if it was yesterday's or another podcast about the mule tape and rope and cordage. That's another big one. Just having a length of rope or a length of wire, anything like that can buy time.
Yeah.
Buy time or buy way out.
I can make cordage out of cactus fibers or whatever. Yeah, go ahead and make me 50 foot of it then.
Yeah.
I'll see you next week. I mean, you know, like where you can buy 300 foot of mule tape for like 15 bucks and it'll tow a truck.
Yeah, there's a certain point of that where the efficiency overweighs the, oh, I can do it. Well, use everything at your disposal. You can go back to bushcraft techniques and use a handsaw to cut something, or use a motorized saw, use a battery saw, do something that's more efficient and saves you time, and for me, can save money.
What about, like, you kind of alluded to this, but Do you have like a specific setup for making sure that you can use solar to charge like your power tools and stuff like that?
Yeah, I upgraded recently. I had an old POS camper that I had basically had water damage, and I gutted it out that I didn't really have any power even in my camper at the time. Yeah. So that's where I've gone to some mounted solar panels. Again, the newer camper, I've done the same thing, but kind of unengineering things and going back to a 12 volt system, even in my camper. I've got a newer camper, but when you go to use the outlets in the wall, it needs to be running a generator versus the lights in, it'll be 12 volts. So I kind of back engineered that camper wiring into the awning motor extensions so that I've got 12 volt power in the camper. And again, solar power keeps me from having to run a generator, even for the lights and the refrigeration, keeping that 12 volt fridge in a camper, just having the uniformity across the spectrum makes it easier to operate and makes it easier to maintain. And with that, the 12 volt, again, I'm DeWalt, and keeping the uniform DeWalt batteries with the 12 volt charger, you plug it in and you can charge everything and away you go. I did, versus mounting the solar panels hard to the camper, I've got them set up kind of on it's not quite a tripod, but on their own mounting plate that you can orient to the sun. And, oh, hey, there's a tree where you want to camp, and you can run a cord and maintain your solar, your solar direction. And just that maintaining that sunshine on the panels is almost more important to me, because Wyoming, I think we're supposed to be like 44 degrees or something for the solar panels to be the most efficiency at our latitude up here. So having it hard mounted even to the camper doesn't get the efficiency that you might want to charge tools. I still maintain gas engines on four wheelers and some of these devices that it requires having gasoline or having a supply, but
sure,
smaller tools, the solar panels are the way to go. Everybody now makes one, but for even the creature comforts of charging my phone and the headphones and entertainment type stuff, having a Goal Zero or one of the smaller, I don't want to even quite call them smaller, but an intermediate solar battery pack is a benefit.
I think that like probably one of the most overlooked solar applications for a lot of homesteaders is just that, though, is maybe a couple panels, a few batteries, two inverters in case one blows up, and now you can charge all your power tools. You've got a little bit of backup power. You're not going to run your house off of it or anything. But I think because people think that that's where they need to get to, they don't understand the stepstone. Because if all your power is out and you have a homestead, the fact that you can run all your tools is generally a good thing at that time, because you're usually fixing shit, right? Stuff usually breaks when the power is out. That's the way that it works. The thing that wasn't going to break until next year, power goes out, it's like it gets a signal through the air, and it's like, I think I'll break myself now, right? So you always end up fixing stuff. And then my other thing with that has always been, if you know how to build, let's say, a couple 300 watts solar panel, a couple batteries wired up properly, you can build yourself a basic solar bank to do the type of thing we're talking about. There's nothing that stops you from doing a full scale for a house, because it's just a scale model.
Yeah, but you could also keep it small and keep it cheap in a lot of those cases versus, okay, I need to buy all of these big panels and micro inverters. You can do the bare minimum. And again, for me, for the camper, it's parked out there with food in the fridge right now, because it's a 12 volt fridge that's running. It's got the lights are 12 volt that you can keep the lights on. And as you talked about in your intro, right now, you guys that might be having power outages or extreme wind events and some of that stuff with what happened in Texas, oh, hey, you can fire up the little chainsaw with a battery and go cut trees to get access to your road or get access to whatever, or even down to hand tools of you need a drill, you need plywood, you need something cut, fixed, what might not be. You can use that and go out and fix or either fix your way to the grid or just maintain what you have and stay survived.
What about medical precautions? Like, you know, when you're out somewhere like that, if you have a maintenance medication, you better have enough of it. If you get hurt, I mean, there is some minimalist thinking there too. I remember one time Dave Canterbury was doing a talk at a place that we were both speaking at, and somebody said, "What's your first aid?" And he had a rag and a roll of duct tape and a hatchet He said, you need more than this where I'm at, then you need a helicopter. But I don't think that you – and he was making a joke, and you know, kind of I got it. But I do think that in the environment you're in, there is a real need to realize you will be your own level of highest care, and maybe for quite some time.
Yeah, as you say, I'm pretty far out. I think probably the closest ambulance where this project I'm at now would be Rawlins. So my closest professional medical help is 45 miles away.
Okay.
They can send in a chopper. I maintain it's more for my wife's comfort, but I maintain a satellite messenger that I can reach out and I can get help, but that's dependent on, okay, do I have the battery on my satellite messenger? Is the battery charged? Do I have service? Is it within reach? Am I bleeding out and it's a foot out of my reach? It does me no good. Anyway, that's kind of my first step is the last resort. I can reach out and, again, they would probably send a helicopter in and it might cost – I maintain some insurances and that it shouldn't bankrupt me, but I think some people would pay $60,000 or who knows. The sky's the limit on if you have to call a helicopter in for a traumatic event. Then scaling it down, most of – it's my preference because I've had a couple – it wasn't even in my working – life. It was a ATV accident. I drove a four-wheeler through a barbed wire gate. Basically, the barbed wire worked as basically as a saw cutting through that outside half of my arm.
Ugh.
And at the time, I was I had to have been 14 at the time, but had to walk not very far. I mean, a quarter mile to help, but walking carrying your arm
because
it had cut the muscles, and then. Somebody threw me in a truck and they hauled ass to the nearest hospital. So anyway, circling back on most of my ATVs, I'll carry a small boo-boo band-aid kit, but I'll also carry a tourniquet just because it seems recently they've made the big influx and they aren't as scary as they used to be. And dealing with barbed wire or sharp metal, there's a very real chance that I can have a cut and that cut can be drastic just like chopping away with a sword. It's a big deal. I'll maintain tourniquets, my satellite messenger, and then kind of for the intermediary, I'm cheap. Frugal. I'll maintain a pretty good medical kit on my truck of, okay, some Dermabond, the skin super glue, vet wrap, ACE bandages, even up to some of not quite like you'd treat a gunshot wound, but some of the bigger gauze pads and I just saw a comment across the bottom of hemostatic bandages and tourniquets. And I don't carry a chest seal because I'm not as likely to get shot unless I do it myself.
Well, yeah, but you're not going to be really good at sealing your own chest. That's the other thing.
No,
right?
But that's just one of those where keeping a full range of medical kit is very handy to have. And it's again, chainsaws, power tools, sharp metal, and even just life in general. You fall down while you're out in the sticks on a sharp stick. And all of a sudden you have a serious injury from a minor slip, trip, fall.
Yeah. Yeah. Things that aren't even that big a deal become a big deal in certain environments due to the lay in help. And due to things like increased infection risk, you mentioned something about vet supplies in your notes. Are you taking your dog out there or are you saving money on medical equipment?
One of the ones that, again, being frugal, there's some of that stuff that drives me insane of, oh, hey, we want X amount of money for this. And my wife and I did a big stock up on vet wrap. And there's a lot of animal medical supplies that'll cross over to people. And other than the packaging on the outside, I don't know the difference, and neither would probably anybody up to a medical professional knows the difference between I have not had to do it yet, but I came close a couple times. I'll keep a medical stapler. It will not be pretty and I will not be happy, but if I absolutely have to put a staple in to keep my arm together to get out of somewhere, even some of that, I don't know if that's available to individuals as a human medical supply, but you can go to a medical vet supply and they don't care. You don't need a license. You don't need any of that to do it. I know it, again, the same thing applies to some of the antibiotics, like using fish mocks and that.
Mm-hmm.
I went because I'm frugal, but not being insane. I did get the Jace case. And I know there's some of the equivalent human medical antibiotics that you can get again, I know they give you a prescription for it, but having that stuff available might keep me or a homesteader working. Okay, I've got a bad cut that's probably going to get infected. Is it easier to go to the ER and have them prescribe stuff, or can I just take some of these antibiotics to keep myself in the work environment on the homestead in the fight, as it were?
Well, and there is a place for it too. I mean, like, here's a product I recommend for dogs called Zymox, and it's really good on like the hot spot type stuff where they start chewing on their foot and they make it worse and worse. But, you know, when you're desperate, you try things. And I had a rash one year from some type of like poison ivy type thing, but I don't get poison ivy, so it was something else. And it was like I was ready to claw the flesh off my arm, and I'm like, let's just hydrocortisone and some enzymes and squirt, and like it was instant. Like, and it worked. To this day, that shit for things like that, ant bites, spider bites, things like that, has worked better than anything else I've tried. And I don't care that it's for dogs, right? It honestly, with some exceptions, because like a dog can eat roadkill off the road and not die because they have a short digestion tract. And high. But in most instances, if I wouldn't use it, I wouldn't give it to my dog. Right. I mean, there is, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of crossover there. And even again, that for itches and bites. And I get bugs. I get a lot of those situations. And I like it's a horse spray. I think it's permectin. It's basically horse bug spray. And I'll put it. I try to avoid direct skin contact on some of that stuff because it might be a little bit more potent or more aggressive because it's intended for a large animal use. But if you put horse bug spray on your boots, or I've even heard of people using like dog flea and tick collars that they'll put in the laces of a boot to keep the ticks from crawling up your leg. And that's something that I've had. Again, I hate ticks. I hate bugs that most of the time I'll wear a long sleeve shirt and keep as minimal skin exposed as possible, but keeping that stuff away, no matter what the method might be.
That gives me a flashback of when we used to go to the field in Panama in the jungle with all the mosquitoes and everything. What would sell out at the PX like a week before everybody went to the field was the stuff for lice and like crabs. And then the day before everybody left, they would take a shower with this stuff, and it would keep bugs off you for about 4 days. I'm sure we all have some sort of cancer growing in us from doing that, but it was effective.
If it works, it's not crazy. Again, there might be long-term effects from some of this stuff, but life is, no matter what, is deadly. So there's only so much you can do some of the time.
Now, we talked a little bit about fuel and reserve fuel, and anything liquid has weight. But like without water, you also die and stuff, and that's not good. So what's kind of your backup solution for water to make sure that you don't run out while you're on a job?
Yeah, I circle back around to the best thing, and that's preparing is planning. And that's what a lot of people need to do, is just have a plan of starting off with the most amount of water I can have, and having my camper has X amount of gallons. And then I'll also keep some of the Walmart blue jugs. So I'll have 10 gallons of quote unquote bulk spare water. And then even down to, I know there's microplastics and everything, but plastic bottles, having cases of water around is a big important deal. Again, just because it's what I had seen on the news earlier and what you had talked about, people in Texas or in different environments that are without power, if you don't have a water pump, you need to make sure that you've got a blue jug or several cases of water, because if you can't pump the water up to your house, or if the city doesn't pump the water to your house, that becomes a big deal to maintain a backup. I also, just as the emergency backup, I've got a couple life straws and a couple of the filtering devices, but I don't want to have to go to that resort. I have it, but I'd rather not go that far.
That also requires surface water to exist.
Yes.
And there's places in Wyoming, you're going a long way before you see water. There's parts of Wyoming, the only reason they're not desert is it doesn't get as hot.
I can't remember exactly. I thought it's supposed to be less than 13 inches of rain or something to require a desert. And we don't normally get that, but we don't get as blasted hot. I don't know where you guys are sitting at, but the project that I was on last week, I got snowed out Thursday. I had 3 or 4 inches of snow, and it's a different situation.
Now we're hitting triple digits some days already. We're also in like a heavy rain year, but my rain could be 14 to 18 inches annual, and it could be 60 inches annual. And those years can come back like back to back to back to back and just swap like that. You just don't know. We're in a very heavy rain cycle this year, but that also means that we have to worry about like swirling clouds of death and hailstones the size of the head of my microphone and shit like that too this year.
Yeah, that's I would rather not deal with the heat or some of the snakes and crawlies that you guys have down Texas way. So that's kind of one of those where I'm happy that Wyoming is the way it is. It's a funny statement or whatever, and you can always put on more clothes, but you can only take off so much before it's illegal.
I've said that many times. Yeah, I can always get warmer, but I can only get so naked, and then I go to jail. You mentioned some of like the crawlies and stuff. Like we do have a lot of things that, like, I had an intern here for a while, and he had been here like 3 weeks, and he got really frustrated. He said, everything in this state wants to bite me, stab me, stick me, or cut me. And it can feel that way, but it's not like where you live, there's no concerns either. We don't really have a bear issue here. I think we both have some snakes. I don't think you have anywhere near the numbers, but I think there are some rattler species in at least parts of Wyoming. Then you've got Mother Nature, snow you mentioned just now, and lightning, heat. And like the one thing about your climate is you can get really hot there and not know it. I noticed that when I was in Montana almost 10 years ago now, where everybody that I was working with was telling me it was over 100 degrees, and I kept telling them to shut up. Like, I thought they were just being stupid, and I finally looked it up, and it was like 101 on the weather app. And I realized how quick you could dehydrate in that environment because you don't know that you're hot because it's so, you know, kind of dry air. Where down here when it's 100, you're like, this is miserable, and you know it. How do you deal with all of that?
Being able to be diverse because there'll be pretty big temperature swings along with the high heat. Again, most of the time it's a dry heat. However, when it gets up to 100 degrees, you're still sweating, you're still overdoing it in some of those temperatures. And I've tried a number of a neck fan or even like the handkerchiefs that you'll soak with ice water to keep cool. Yeah. And for me, some of the best thing to do is just to take a break and go rehydrate. And a lot of the times if I'm in the field, I try and work long days. It'll be spring or summertime that I've got the most sunlight I'll have, and I'll kind of split the day up into two different, not really aligning with noon, but okay, 2 o'clock, go in, hydrate as much as possible, and then go back to it for another 6 or 8 hour day, because you can use that break to hydrate, refresh, eat all of that and keep going. It's a little bit off the radar, but one of the ones that I struggle with some of the time is the vitamins and cramping and some of that. When you get the extreme heat, I don't know how you are down there, but if I'm doing a long day, if I've got 20,000 steps on my watch by the end of the day, there's a pretty good chance at the middle of the night I'm going to have leg cramps or have some type of other physical issue after a long, hard day. And I think that crosses over even to a self-sustaining or a homestead. It's a lot of work, whether it's hot, whether it's cold. It's a lot of work gathering firewood. It's a lot of work doing garden work or doing anything. So I'll try and maintain kind of with the medical supplies, some of the anti-cramp stuff and potassium and Gatorade and some of the extra bonuses. Straight water is huge. However, being able to maintain a Gatorade or something like that to keep your body going is a big deal. I had recently got into the volunteer firefighting, and one of the things they recommend if you're out in the field is a Gatorade of water, swapping those in and out to maintain electrolytes and maintain some of the vitamins and just keep your body going no matter what the elements throw at you.
Yeah, I mean, I say every summer that the sun tries to kill us, and I'm only half joking when I talk about this climate and that. And I honestly need to get this written up for the website. This is a product that I use, available on Amazon, Nunsport Electrolyte. It doesn't seem cheap, but it's way cheaper than Gatorade, and it doesn't have the sugar.
Well, it's a big one, and I've liked those. As I'm looking at it, I think I had got some of the strawberry lemonade, and they were spot on for me. Yeah. And adds a little bit of flavor while keeping you from going off the deep end for cramps and stuff. And it's a little bit grosser off the radar, but at 2 in the morning, if I've got a leg cramp and I'm about to pee myself because my legs are locked up and I can't move. I'd rather spend the couple dollars on some Noon or some type of mineral.
I'm just saying, I definitely endorse those for what we're talking about for people in general listening to us today. The other thing is there's something about that flavor that I drink faster and I drink more. And I think that's one of the things some people struggle with, drinking enough. I think if you were in the military, they Army anyway, you know how to drink water because they force you to. But and it's an advantage in some ways, but definitely keeping hydrated is huge.
I struggle more with the hydration in the winter time because it's cold and I don't want to drink the water. And that's where you're not quite having the label on a big bottle of drink water every hour. But I've got to force it when I'm cold more than when I'm hot.
Yeah, we do a rule at our workshops. We have a lot of rules, but one of them is, and it doesn't matter if it's a winter workshop, it's the same thing. Everybody look after each other, and anybody can tell anybody to drink. And if somebody tells you to drink, you shut up and you drink. You don't explain that you don't need to. It won't hurt you to drink a little extra water. If somebody thinks you need to drink some water, you probably need to drink some water.
Yeah, my dad was in the National Guard back in the day, and that's one of the ones that they did in Minnesota, so they did a snow march or did something along those lines. And he had told me, you're supposed to look at your buddy's pee on the snow, and you can kind of tell, like, hey, you got to drink up before you crash, because I can see it in the yellow snow cone.
Yeah, darker is not better. That's a bad thing. And when somebody drinks a lot of water and it's still dark, you may never catch up in that situation. Yeah. You may be looking at IV needs at that point. What about, you know, for off-grid self-reliance, are there some self-rescue tools that you find to be important? Again, if you got a dead battery out there, you got a problem. If you're out of fuel, you got a problem. Like, you don't want to be stranded.
Yeah, one of those big ones, I know I had mentioned it, but having it for everybody's car has enough space to put some type of a jump start or an air inflator type deal. And that was a big one last summer. Again, probably 40 miles from civilization, probably 8 or 10 miles from the closest person. I get in, I'm by myself, get in to start the truck, and a dead battery. You kind of say, oh shit, in a hurry when it's, okay, I'm intending to go home. I'm hoping my wife would figure out that I'm not able to make it. But after that, I started packing a jump box with a tire inflator, just because it has that little bit of extra benefit of being able to air up a tire. And another one that just said, with ATVs and especially doing some of the fence work, driving over sagebrush, driving over old barbed wire and staples, is maintaining a tire patch kit and being able to put a plug in a tire or something like that. Taking an ATV tire off the rim is a pain in the ass that I don't want to do that, but I can wedge a plug in to get something moving or keep going, keep working. Another one that it's a small thing, but I like milk crates on the front of my four wheelers just because I can throw stuff in them. Okay. On the side of most of those, along with the tourniquet, I've got a fire extinguisher. Because something small can get very big in a hurry. Yeah. And if, again, the proximity to other emergency services, if you can do something in the first 30 seconds to put out a fire, whether that's your truck, your camper, your four-wheeler, your homestead, if you can act quickly and have access to a fire extinguisher, that can be the difference between, oh, hey, I burnt my truck, or, oh, hey, I lit a 10,000-acre grass fire. It can be a big, I don't know that it qualifies as self-rescue, but self-control of a situation is a big deal when you're on your own, or if you're on the homestead, or if you're, again, all the power lines down. If you've got a fire going, the best thing you can do, call for help, but also put it out yourself.
Yeah. You keep mentioning in your notes, and I think you've said it a couple times, a handyman jack. When you say that, are you talking about like a high lift jack?
Yeah. Okay. A handyman jack, a high lift jack, they are not the right tool for a lot of things, but you can use them to do the wrong thing to get stuff done. Yeah. One of the ones I carry, it's got a hook attachment for both ends that you can use that handyman as a winch to get yourself out of a spot. Or even I did it once in snow of driving along and fell through the crust of snow, jack the truck up, wedge logs and branches and anything that was loose that you could get underneath the tires to get yourself out, or let alone using it for closer to an intended purpose of changing a flat tire or anything along those lines. Because when it circles back around for me, I might be out in the toolies, but it comes to everybody in a car should be able to change the tire in that car. They should be have the wrench to do so, and having a spare tire is a huge deal.
I want to change the driving test. I don't give a shit if a person can parallel park. I can't tell you the last time that I had to parallel park somewhere. Not being able to do the most basic shit to a car, like change a tire. To me, I don't know that if you can't put your own gas in and change a tire, I don't know you should be driving a car.
That's a pretty good way to look at it. And even down to people should have the general maintenance stuff. If you can do preemptive general maintenance, it saves you out in the field. If you're, again, out in the toolies and you run out of oil because you haven't checked the oil in 3 months and blow up your engine, it's even worse because now no tow truck is going to come out to where you are to get it. Or if you're out in the homestead, even your small engines and ATVs, maintaining good oil and maintaining some of that stuff, you can make your investment last a lot longer as well with some of the maintenance and that self-knowledge of keeping a clean air filter and keeping good oil in stuff.
How to change your oil, how to check your freaking coolant level, how to check your freaking squirty juice for your windshield wiper. Like, just that basic stuff, I just feel like that should be, for as much money as we spend on education, that should be, a required basics course in high school. It's a one-day thing, how your car works.
That day might save people a lot of time and effort down the road. I graduated in 2008, but a long time ago in high school, I had a flat tire on the little truck I had, and I had some people. I went to go see a girl I was dating. She came out of her house with a friend and watched me change the tire. This would have been 2006, and even then they were, "What are you doing?"
Because you could do that yourself. Do you have a license to change tires? Are you certified? Yeah. Right?
I've been driving on gravel roads since I was 14. I've changed a lot of tires just out of necessity.
What about as far as getting stuck? I was mentioning come-alongs, winches. That would seem like a no-brainer in the environment you're in.
Yeah, I maintain most of the four-wheelers and stuff. I'll keep a winch on. I'm in a lot of sagebrush country a lot of the times there's not as much to – you can hook onto a sagebrush and yank it out of the ground before it actually gets you going. So I've got a receiver hitch winch that I can put in front or back of my pickup, I've got a plate that'll even go on the front of a skid steer that I can winch my skid steer out with itself if necessary. And again, if you can jack something up or maintaining some of the traction boards, they don't really work as ramps because they're just molded plastic. But I don't even know the brand name for them, but the off-road adventures that you see in a Jeep with the multicolored board on the roof rack, those will serve a purpose. I had a welding project a little while ago, kind of in some irrigated farmland, and the four-wheeler's getting stuck because I'm dragging a welder behind it, and you can lay down those traction ramps to get through or over something. They don't work as a ramp per se. I'm not going to load a four wheeler with them.
Yeah.
They can work to get you out of the jam.
Yeah. Yeah. And you bring up an interesting thing there. So when I was in the military and ran a wrecker in the jungle, there's always a giant tree somewhere that you can either connect the vehicle you're extracting to winch out with it. Or if you're using the wrecker, that thing really wasn't going anywhere anyway, but the smaller 5-ton wreckers, we would moor those to a tree so that we didn't pull ourselves instead of pull the target vehicle. But you get out on those open plains, there just may not be anything to you can reach anyway to put that come along or that winch or anything on.
And another one though is people can get creative. Most of the time I'll have a roll of barbed wire or a roll of something with me, and it is not the best, but you can use I'm sure everybody's seen them at Tractor Supply, the fence stretcher and a roll of wire. I've got a quarter mile of wire. I don't want to string that out and have to roll it back up. But if you've got a short stretch, we talked about some of the side-by-sides and stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of them are belt driven, and I drove one crossing an irrigation ditch, and then the belt got wet, so it wouldn't drive. Now I'm in the middle of the road in an irrigation ditch in a field. There's nothing to connect to. So I had stretched out wire and used a fence stretcher. It's not again, not the right tool, but you can be creative and problem solve your way out of things with what you have some of the time.
Yeah, definitely. Have you maybe come across some other work aspects that can be helpful with people thinking about modern survival? Like you mentioned volunteer firefighting. I mean, metalworking as a thing itself seems like it's pretty applicable to a lot of things. I know you like your gun guy. I can tell by your Instagram.
Yeah, there's all of those kind of come into play. The volunteer firefighting thing, it's been 2.5 years that I've been doing some of that. You start off on a probationary period, but the volunteer firefighting was just an eye opener in general. It's for somebody homesteading or the like, one of the big things, it's free training on a lot of aspects, but then you also start to learn more of your area. We've been in this community for, I guess it's been 8 going on 9 years now, but I didn't know a lot of the names to places. I didn't know a lot of the setups. Again, my kids are young that I haven't been to the high school or been to certain areas and the like, that I've learned a lot about my community just by responding to some of the volunteer fire department calls. You also will learn I don't know how to say politically correct way to do it, but you learn some of the rough areas of, even in Wyoming, we have areas that there are more incidents or more problems with because of the community.
Because of the people who live there. There's no way around that. Because of the people that live there.
Yeah. And you learn that. And that's, again, the grid goes down or something like that. You know what, within reason, you know, some of the areas are going to be higher issues than others. They're not going to help themselves out of a situation. They're going to kind of just get whatever they can get.
You know, I think also in some of these more rural areas, things like volunteer fire department, or even things that aren't even like that, but like if you're a veteran, like VFW or something like that, they can get you tied in with the local population at a level that otherwise you wouldn't be accepted. Like, so who's he? That's Chris or Cody and Jack. Yeah, and right. Like, oh, well, who the fuck is he? Well, he's on the volunteer fire. Okay. Right. Like, yeah. Where I grew up in Pennsylvania was a lot like that. It's like the edge of Appalachia, but it's still Appalachian. Like, you know, the joke is if you move there, your great grandchildren might be considered local someday, right? And it's not that bad, but there's a reason for the stereotype. But as soon as that person is like volunteer fire department, member of the Rod and Gun Club, any one of the predominant churches that they're involved or whatever, all of a sudden it's just like, oh, well, no, he's one of us. And it's a weird thing, but if that's what it takes, you know, then that's what it takes.
Well, and it's a little bit of a skimp around on stuff, but even having the volunteer license plate or volunteer placard above your license plate,
yeah,
I might be able to get onto a closed road, or I might have an HP that just gives me the hand wave instead of writing me a ticket because, hey, you're part of the community and you're trying to help out. And again, I didn't do it to learn about the community or do some of that. I was trying to be helpful, but it also gives you certain passes on issues or certain leeway in some place that people might not. And if the grid goes down, I know where and how to drive the deuce and a half from the fire hall to my house that I can have some extra water here if I needed to. Not that I'm going to do that, but that's just something that you learn.
You're faced with the decision to have to do a thing. That's the reality there.
That's also fair.
You know, I definitely think there is a place to tie into those local organizations and things like that. You end up meeting people. You end up with a bigger, broader network, and that's everything in the world today.
I've met some fellow preppers and learned about a lot of things, and there's a lot of hoops to jump through and a lot of BS as well. However, that's one of those where there's good and bad with every situation.
Are there any areas of, you know, preparedness, survivalism that you feel maybe you're lacking in at this point that you'd like to improve, especially that maybe doing this kind of work made you realize that?
Yeah, there's stuff that I've always been lacking on. For growing up on a ranch, I was more about growing livestock and the like. And one of the big ones that you guys are always talking about is the self-sufficiency when it comes to food and aspects like that. That I have a garden. I've been trying to do better about growing our own food and vegetables, and that's where I find that I'm lacking, because I got away from state trails because I got tired of traveling, and then I still do some travel for work. And if I can't maintain a garden, or, oh, hey, I'm going to be gone for a week and a half. My wife has both of our boys, and she does awesome. However, sometimes it's a lot of a pain if you don't have your garden to self drip irrigate or do this or that. You've got to take care of. And I feel like that's one of my big flaws when it comes to survival and preparedness would be the growing the greens. I'm trying, but that's one of those that I have big plans, and then work or family pushes that to the background. And
understood.
And then you can't get it done. One of the other ones, I'm for being a fairly big guy, as everything needs, I need to lose weight, like 90, not 90, but like a good majority of the country. Physical fitness, I'm physically active and I'm out doing stuff. However, you can always do more to improve yourself. With the volunteer fire stuff, there's some minimum requirements for that. They call it the pack test, where you're supposed to, I know with the military, it's probably a much significantly bigger ruck march and the like, but kind of a minimum standard would be for the fire guys is the pack test of 3 miles with 45 pounds in 45 minutes. And it's just basically a brisk walk. And again, I'm there and I'm physically able to do my work stuff. But when you're sweating after a 4 mile an hour walk with a pack, makes you second guess, oh, doing the a bug out or doing the going home series. And, oh, hey, I've got to walk 100 miles home.
Yeah,
it brings into question your physical fitness. And in that case, brings to question how much crap can you carry and how much is reasonable versus actual versus desired. I got a 60-pound bug-out bag. If you do that and a 40-pound child, it makes that bug-out bag not worth carrying.
No, you start needing a cart at some point if you're going to get anywhere with stuff like that. You know, it's been a great conversation. I think one of the things that you take away from something like this is anything that separates you from the convenience that we're so accustomed to helps you form a better mental picture of what you need to do to be prepared if that happens when you don't want it to. That's why, like, I'll tell people, like, going camping is a great preparedness mindset thing to do. And it's not because if the shit hits the fan and the zombies rise, we're going to all go to the state park and camp and survive in, you know, out on Locust Lake or something like that. It's because it does cut off the convenience. Yeah, the camping place that's at the state park, there's probably a little shop with ice and shit that's 15 minutes away. But you know that you failed. When you're like, yeah, I got to go down to the store, I'll be back in half an hour. You know that you failed, and it kind of puts you in touch with, like, well, what if that wasn't an option? And I think anything that forces us to do without that which we've become spoiled to have, I think helps us get the mindset in the right direction.
Yeah, camping is a test run for a bug out trip. It's just the stakes are a lot lower, and that makes it an easier thing. Oh, hey, I forgot the lighter to cook to start the bonfire. It's easier to forget something small when it's not a life or death situation or anything like that, because it's, again, low stakes with high learning availability.
Yeah. Let's hit a few questions. One, I think, is just Jake being a pain in the ass again. He says, do you make coffee with solar? I my opinion is that making heat with solar is about the least efficient way to use solar energy on planet Earth. There is, you know, I can make a pot of water boil in about, you know, 3 minutes with some scrap wood. And so that's just not an application I would do. And I just think it's Jake likes to ask a lot of questions.
No to Jake. I'm not a big coffee guy. My mom, my mom grew up and she had what I think was terrible choice in instant coffee. And it ruined coffee for me for life that
good choice in instant coffee. Right. Yeah, so that just doesn't exist, like Sanka or some shit. Like, yeah.
I'm burned out on coffee, so I don't have to worry about that one.
It's probably the least used thing in an MRE was a little packet of instant coffee, unless it got mixed into something to make a coffee-flavored dessert. Hey, Alabama says, are the new small jumper cables and inflators for tires any good? He's talking about like a little do-it-all jump packs, and I think they're useful, and I have no problem with having them. But in addition to that, I've always been big on having a really good set of standard jumper cables, because that pack may or may not work when you want it to. And here's kind of my criteria for jumper cables. If I hand them to you and you've never picked up a pair like that before, you go, damn, those are heavy. If you don't say, damn, those are heavy, you got the cheap ones. I want thick, heavy, badass. I want to be able to arc weld if I have to with a pair of them.
Yeah, there's a certain, if you don't have if the gauge of the wire isn't big enough in there, if you've got a super dead battery, or you're jumping a large vehicle that needs a higher cold cranking amps or whatever the metric is, you need those heavy duty ones. And if you've got a cheap set that the alligator clamp doesn't stay on that battery terminal, not only are you mad about having a dead battery, but you're mad that your jumper cables won't stay where you clicked them onto. I've had reasonable luck with some of the smaller jump boxes, just at the size of a, I don't even know what you'd reference the size as, like a 3x3x8 little jump box.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's a fancy lithium. Great. Yeah. A fancy lithium battery, but it still is slowed by the gauge of your wire. You can only force so much electricity through something when it's got speaker wire on it before the wire starts to melt. And the other one on some of the new smaller ones, at least for me, that I've realized is a lot of them are too smart for their own good. If your battery is too dead, it won't recognize that it's clipped onto a battery and won't want to work anyway. So there's a certain aspect of they made it safe, but that safety made it
not work.
Made it.
Well, I mean, because here's where I was going to go with that. Like, generally, you don't plan for your battery to go dead. Right. There are times that we end up with a battery we know is on its last legs and we're pushing it till we can get it where we're going to replace it. But usually the battery's not dead and then it's dead. And something can happen, like, oh, somebody goes to your truck to get some shit out of it and leaves the lights on or something. And it's an older one that doesn't turn itself off. And so when you go to start that vehicle, that's exactly where I was going. It's so dead that it needs a significant amount of power put into it before it will even start. There's my battery's dead, and what that means is when you turn the ignition, it goes,
It tries, at least.
It tries, or it goes click, 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 or something like that. And then there's dead, which when you turn your headlights on, they don't even come on. The radio don't work. That DEA all the way dead, right?
Yeah.
And when you're there, I've taken, you know, like a larger pickup or whatever. It's got a kind of a Haas alternator on it, and you hook the two vehicles up, and you let the good vehicle just idle. And you might have to let that idle for 15, 20 minutes or so before you'll get that other one to kick in. And now it can, you know, assuming that it's not completely gone or the alternator's not out, it can charge itself at that point.
Yeah, and that even comes down to, again, I'm big on ATVs, and hooking a small, what would basically be a lawn and garden battery off of an ATV to a full-size vehicle, there's a difference in, again, some of the smaller vehicles would struggle to jump something that's giant. There's a reason that semis have large batteries. There's a reason that even a truck battery versus a car has different sizes. And I circle back around to the ATV side. One of my big ones that I love, my poor old Honda Rancher ATVs, most of them still have, they've got a battery, but they've got a pull cord. You take off a piece of plastic and you can get access to a manual, the hand pulled cord to start something that when all else fails, you can still yank on that, even if all your batteries are dead or anything like that. Having a manually started gas engine can circle back around.
Jake also said, and we were talking about pulling things out where there's no trees, you know, 3-foot spike and a 2-pound hammer. And I said, you all want to bring 2 spikes, because 2 is 1 and 1 is none, and that spike may never come out of the ground. But what it did make me think of, and I've done this because I had the stuff with me, because it was actually a fencing job we were doing. We got stuck. There wasn't really anything to moor to. We had T-posts and a pounder. And the beauty of that is we pounded it in, and if you know how to do it, a T-post pounder, you turn it over on the ground, and basically each of those little teeth on the T-post, you can get under there, and you can use it to lever the damn thing back up out of the ground.
Yeah, depending how stuck you get, I did that with a side by side once, and I broke the T post off, and then I've got a jagged piece of metal sticking out of the ground in front of where I'm driving. But yeah, you can do a lot, and I know it'll also depend on how stuck you are and what you're stuck in. If you're in snow or in a swamp, you can drive a T-post in or a spike in and it'll just pull out of the ground because the soil won't hold what you're talking about. But again, it'll work. It's just a difference of how well it works.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there is always the concept of, well, how stuck are you? I remember I asked a guy one time that was selling tornado shelters. And I said, well, how many people will this, you know, protect? He said, how scared are you? Because the scarier you are, the more people you'll cram in there. So, yeah.
That might turn into a clown car, but you might save more people in that in a tornado shelter case.
Yeah, yeah. So real quick, you do have a website, and it is gfmwyo.com.
Yeah.
And yep. You want to tell people about that before we wrap up?
Yeah, that's the website. My recent venture, kind of with what you say and kind of with what others have said, I've branched out into trying to make some vehicle accessories that I can sell from my own house and not have to leave. So okay. That's what you're kind of scrolling over there. It also gave me a reason to buy some body armor and some other stuff. So that's been my new product line. But if anybody's in Wyoming needing rough terrain fence work, or if you're basically anywhere in the U.S. that you need body armor hangers or smaller metal fabrication products, I can ship products to people and can help out wherever I can. Or if you need something custom or weird, I always like problem solving for anything different.
I'll say, well, on your Instagram there, and that's not real tactical, but it's kind of cool. You got this little undermount thing for like ball jars.
Yeah,
under a cabinet. Like, so you get into metal fabrication, and you can anything you can do with metal, you can figure out how to do. That's a pretty cool little product there. It's kind of a wine glass hanger, but it's made for ball jars.
Yeah, it worked out pretty good. Again, it's an idea that I was able to snag from somebody else online and then transfer it to my own thing. Again, my wife liking the canning process. It's easier to store stuff if you keep everything organized. And I got the laptop. I call it my wife's witch's shelf because it's got a bunch of natural different elements of jars and stuff, but keeping stuff organized and accessible makes it easier to get to.
Cool, man. Well, anyway, I really appreciate you being with us today, Cody. This has been a great interview, and I will have links to your Facebook, your Instagram, your website, all that stuff in the show notes. And folks, there's a link down in the video notes if you're not listening to the audio. And there's a link there in the first sentence. It'll take you over to the audio side with all of those resources and everything else we talked about today. And it will work really, really soon. But if you do it right now and you're watching it live, we're not done yet, so it's not there yet. Because every time I get somebody, the link doesn't work. Well, we're not finished. But we almost are. So with that, Cody, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. And have a good one. Stay survived in all the weather you guys have going.
All right, man. Take care. All right, folks, real quick so we can wrap up. I do want to talk to you about our item of the day today, which are releasable cable ties. And Monoprice is a brand that I've recommended, but when I put these up today, they were on sale, and they almost sold out in about 10 minutes, and they were down to an inventory of like 5, and I'm like, that'll never make it to the end of the day. So I have found a backup brand. They're the same product. They're side by side. You can't tell them apart. And the good news is they're actually on sale for a little bit less. You can get 100 of these things for a whopping $6. Now, if you go down to Home Depot and you buy zip ties at Home Depot, you're going to pay more than $6 for 100 of them, and they don't do what these do. And what these do are two things really well. One, they're a very thick, wide frame zip tie, which means they're strong. They have like 40-pound tensile strength, and it's a hell of a lot more than that, honestly. But they're releasable, and this is like the thing I want. I don't own tie wraps that don't do this anymore because they don't cost anymore and they work so much better. They have a little tab on them, and when you want to take them off and reuse them somewhere else, you push the tab and you take them off. And I've had people say, Jack, did you know that with a piece of wire, you can do that with any tie wrap? And yeah, if you want to pick a lock every time you use a tie wrap, you go ahead and you do that. These just work so much better. I use them for so many things. One of the things I use them for is right now I'm actually staking up all my pepper plants. They're getting to the point where they start falling over, and I just use bamboo stakes and just one or two of these on it. I use mule tape for more of the vining crops and all, but for just staking up peppers, eggplants, These are fantastic for that. We use them just about everywhere. I keep a bundle of these in every freaking glove box. My trucks, everywhere. All my toolboxes have a bundle of these. Every cabinet has a bundle of these. Out at my garden, I have a little piece of pipe mounted on the back of one of my uprights, and that it just stays full of a handful of these because they're so useful. And we were talking about getting vehicles home. I'll tell you a story about using cable ties that I'm not advising you to do this, but it's a real story. Back when I was in the Army, I think we were about 20 years old, me and my buddy Brad and Dean, we were thick as thieves, and Dean had a truck and we didn't. But that meant we all had a truck, because if we ever needed it, he'd just say, here, take the keys and go. And so one day, Brad and I decided we need to run the PX. Of course, that means we needed beer. And so we're going to do a beer run. So Dean just throws the keys to Brad. We get in the truck. And Brad is a redneck coon ass from South Louisiana. And the boy does not go around a turn without making tires make sound. So we go hauling ass down, hauling ass back, and we get back, and Brad throws the keys to Dean, and Dean says, yeah, I probably should have told y'all that you should take it easy on the truck until the new tie rod gets here. And I'm like, you know, we're all mechanics, so we're like, what? What did you just say? He said, oh, yeah, the tie rod's broken, so I tie wrapped it together. So Brad and I get down. We look up underneath, and I mean, it wasn't, like, loose, or it was broke. And the tie rod, for those that don't know, the linkage, it goes to like, so you can steer. And he just tie wrapped it with four tie wraps back together. Brad near killed him. And then we all thought it was funny later, because when you're 20, you're stupid. And we were so 20 and so stupid. But that just gives you an idea of the flexibility of these things. I use them. I can see three different places are being used in my shop right now. They're holding up plant lights. They're holding wires together. They're just fantastic, and they're cheap. And they're black, so they're UV stable as well. They will get brittle after about a year and a half, 2 years in the direct sun, but that beats the hell out of anything from Home Depot and Lowe's. So check them out today, and remember, you can always find all my product recommendations at tspaz.com. Also consider becoming a member of the MSB. If you do that, you support the show at about 18 cents an episode. And that is the main way we pay the bills around here. I probably don't push as much as I used to. But anyway, with that, guys, take care. I will catch you tomorrow with an expert counsel show for the week. We'll have a Friday flashback. And finally, next week, we will be back and do it all again, regularly scheduled programming after all the disruptions that we had. We're finally back and at it. Oh, and tomorrow will be episode 3500. Take care, guys. Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.